Sunday, June 22nd at 11 p.m. on the hills of Vision Festival 19, Sugar My Bowl presents percussionist drummer Hamid Drake. Join us as we look at the career of this very versatile artist. That's Sunday, June 22nd at 11 p.m. right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. Sugar in My Bowl is here on time. Thank you, David Kenny. You know, those who stayed tuned last week, they were able to hear more Jimmy Scott than they probably would have heard. But I thank you so much, David Kenny, for being here and being a trooper. And, oh, I really don't want that to ever happen again. Our guest this evening is Hamid Drake, drummer, percussionist. Hamid Drake. We're sort of wrapping up the Vision 19 this year, and Hamid is a regular at that festival. So stay tuned, learn something about a musician and how he rolls, and maybe it'll inspire you musically. What's the name of this show? Come on. Yeah? Yeah, I heard her. What does she say again? There it is. I want some sugar. In my
поехали. Тихи са бигу луади, унявци в джуба на пълле. Тихи дъгла бабам, на върху нявци в джуба на пълле. И ляхи личи нявци, зорали у лъмбъл.
My name's Joyce Jones, and I'm on the line with...
My name is Hamid Drake.
Hi, Hamid Drake. Thank you so much for joining Sugar in My Bowl.
You're welcome. Happy to be here.
Oh, I'm so glad we were able to do this. And it was, I got to tell you, it was really great seeing you at Vision Festival 19.
Thank you so much. It's always a pleasure to play in New York and to play at the Vision Festival in particular, and also with the wonderful artists, you know, that I get a chance to perform with there and to see perform, and all the good friends that I get to see also, and many of the friends that I usually, sometimes I don't get to see them unless it is a Vision Festival, so it's always a great experience for me to be there.
I understand that you were born in Monroe, Louisiana?
That is correct.
And did you stay there for long before you left for Chicago?
No, I was brought up to Chicago when I was pretty young, but my family, we would, every summer throughout my teenage years, we would always go back to Louisiana, so it would be like the school months would be in Chicago, and we spend the whole summer in Louisiana with family and relatives. And I still go down there at least twice a year, particularly to New Orleans to perform and stuff.
Actually, that's exactly where I was going. That had to be an interesting combination between being in Chicago and in Louisiana musically for you. What was that like?
Well, not so much musically in a way, because I was a little older when I started playing, but I'll say more than musically, culturally.
Mm.
You know, because the South at that time was very different than the North. I mean, it still is in many respects, but we would visit family that lived in Monroe, you know, kind of in the city, and then we would also spend quite a bit of time out in a place called Luella and in Winfield and in McIntosh, and those were pretty country places, you know, where a lot of sugar cane is grown, and at that time there were still cotton fields and stuff like that.
Mm.
And I've been tried picking cotton a couple times.
Ouch.
Ouch. And it's something that I swore that I would never, ever do again in life. So culturally, foods were different. The way people spoke was different. It's like another dialect going on.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And also, they weren't like any the peer. You know, when you're a kid, you go to the baseball field. You know, in some neighborhoods, you know, you're doing different types of sports and stuff. But there, it was very different. It was a whole different cultural experience and different way of life.
Did you soak up most of your musical exposure in Chicago?
No, it was both places, because I grew up listening to a lot of R&B and funk and stuff like that, and also music in the church. And so it was a very similar experience in the South, too, with the blues and things like that. So, yeah, there was musical influences from both places.
Now begins the question with regard to what you do. What begat what? Drumming beget percussion, or percussion beget drumming?
That's an interesting question, because drumming is percussion also.
Mm-hmm.
Well, actually, probably the first instrument that I started off with was bongos. I was playing those in the church.
Oh.
Yeah. And then I started studying the standard drum set, starting the snare drum and big bass drum in the stage band in grade school. And to tell you the truth, at first, that's not what I wanted to do. What I really wanted to play was the trombone.
Oh.
But at that time, there were musical programs in schools, so kids would be given instruments to practice on and take home, but there weren't any more trombones left. So if I was going to be in the stage band, which I really wanted to be, I had to play snare drum and a big orchestral bass drum with this other student. We would switch off. So I did that for a little while, and, you know, studying snare drumming, you know, rudiments and stuff like that with the drum teacher that was at the school. His name was Harry Hawthorne, learning all the paradiddles and flams and long stroke, low short stroke, all the different types of rudiments. And then probably after maybe a year or so went by, my parents had bought me a bass drum and, you know, cymbal stand and cymbal and hi-hat. I already had the snare drum. So I had kind of like half a drum kit, and I began practicing, you know, on that too at home, you know, listening to records and stuff like that and playing along with records. Particularly at that time, I was playing along with a lot of the music of James Brown, and also there was a group from New Orleans that I was really into. Now I play along with them a lot. It's a group called The Meters.
Yes, later the Funky Meters.
Yeah, later the Funky Meters. And also groups like the Bar Kays and stuff like that. And then just, you know, sometimes just listening to the radio also and playing along with that, whatever came on. And then a few years later, I had friends that were playing instruments, and so we started forming little bands to play together. That went on until I was like about 15 or so.
Okay.
And then I started studying congas, Afro-Cuban drumming. I met someone who's still a friend. His name's Adam Rudolph.
Yes.
We met each other at one of the drum shops down in the Loop in Chicago, downtown Chicago. It was called Frank's Drum Shop. And he asked me what I played. What he played. He said he just started studying congas with this guy that had moved from Brooklyn, New York, and he was studying Afro-Cuban drumming. He was teaching Afro-Cuban drumming. And he said if I was interested in congas and if I wanted to attend the class, they gave me the guy's number. So I called him. His name is Howie. And I started going to his class, which was at another drum shop down the street from Frank's. It's called Drums Unlimited. And so I purchased a conga. I think I bought a gumba conga. Because, you know, usually there's three different size drums in the family. There's a quinto conga and tumba gorda.
Right.
So I bought a conga, and I began studying the basics of congas from him and learning some of the Afro-Cuban rhythms. And then a couple of years later, I met my first tabla teacher. His name was Ramon Papilla, and I started studying tabla with him. So that's how the other percussive stuff kind of came about. But it's interesting because I was listening to that music before I actually started playing the instruments. So I was listening to people like Mongol Santa Maria, and also I heard some of the music of Ravi Shankar, and I loved the sound of the tablas, you know, and so I guess fate or destiny pulled me in that direction, and one day I was in Drums Unlimited, and it was after a conga class. I saw on the bulletin board, it said that anyone that was interested in learning drums from India, the tabla, call this particular number, so that's what I did. Then other drumming came about later, too, you know, like the frame drum and stuff like that, and listening to and studying percussion from other countries, too.
So when did you start digging with all of this information?
The concerts that we did in grade school and stage band, I mean, those were gigs, too, but, you know, those were just for, like, the school and stuff like that. But we actually made, like, you know, maybe $2 or something like that, you know.
So you mentioned having met Adam Rudolph when you were 15. You know, I'd read that you'd known each other for a long time. I didn't quite know it was that long. Were you playing together from that moment?
No, we started playing together a few years after that, because Adam was, you know, later on, he was playing with different people in the Chicago area as well as myself. And the first person that I think we actually played together with was Fred Anderson. And then in September of 1977, we formed a group called the Mandingo Griot Society. And it featured a choir player from the Gambia, Jali Fode Musasuso, Adam, myself, and a bass player from Chicago, Joe Thomas. But Adam and I, we had been playing together prior to that with Fred. And Adam, he took a trip to Ghana, West Africa, to the city of Accra, and he was studying Ghanaian drumming with one of the great drummers and musicians from there, Kakwa Balobi. And so he met Suso, even though Suso's from Gambia, he met him in Ghana, because Suso was brought to Ghana by the Institute of African Studies that was at the University of Ghana in Takla to teach traditional music from the Gambia and the Sahel. So he was teaching Kora and Konting or Ngoni. He was teaching music of Gambia, Senegal, Mali. And so they met there, and then Sousa wanted to come to the States anyway, so the idea was conceived. He would come back with Adam, and a group would be started. And so Adam, he wrote me from Ghana when he was still there, and he told me that he had met this young Kora player from the Gambia, Forty Musa Sousa, and he asked me if I would like to start this group with them. And so I said, yes. And it was the same time that Alex Haley's book Roots came out. So there was like a deep and heavy interest in music, particularly from that particular region, the region of Gambia, Senegal, Mali, Conakry, Guinea, those places. Prior to that, it was probably more of an interest in music from Ghana and Nigeria. And so, yeah, Musa came, and the day after he arrived, we met. And the day after that, we went to a couple of different bass players, and then we wound up with Joe Thomas on bass. And we started playing concerts, you know, in and around Chicago area, and then started touring the States, and then we started just some tours of Europe.
Yeah.
about a year and a half after the group was together. This record label approached us called Flying Fish, which was based out of Chicago. And on the Flying Fish label, there were already people like Sweet Honey and the Rock.
Exactly.
Actually, the guy who started Flying Fish, Bruce Kaplan, he used to come to this club in Chicago called the Wise Fools, and he would hear us play there. Sometimes we played every Thursday night, and he would come out to the gigs, and one day he approached us and asked us if we'd like to record on his label, Flying Fish. And we said, sure, that'd be great, only under one condition. And he said, okay, what's that? We said that is that we could have any special guests that we wanted, someone that was really into the whole world music thing, too. He said, okay, who is it? And we said, we'd like to invite Don Cherry to come and do this record with us.
Wow.
And so Don was living in Sweden at the time, and this was the summer of 78, actually. And so Flying Fish flew him from Sweden to Chicago, and we recorded our first record with Don Cherry. And that's when, first time, we all met Don.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-
New York.
We were friends up until he passed away, and did a lot of tours of the United States, Europe with Don, and we did a U.S. State Department tour of West Africa together, along with American Indian saxophone player by the name of Jim Pepper. From that first meeting, it evolved into this long musical relationship and just a pretty strong friendship. We became very close with his wife, Moki, his daughter, Nana Cherry, and his son, Eagle Eye. Also.
Right.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم صل على سيدنا محمد الفاتح لما أغلق وكاتم لما سبق نصر الحق بالحق وهدي الله صراطك المستقيم والله إليه حق قدره ومجال العظيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الله لا إله إلا هو الحي القيوم لا تأخذه سنة ولا نوم
ma fi samawati wa ma fi al-ard man alladhi yashfa'u 'indahu illa bi'idhnihi ya'lamu ma bayna yadayhim wa ma khalfahum wa la yuhituna bi shay'in min 'ilmihi illa bima syaa'a wa siya'a samawati wal ard Mandaladi Ashwau in the Hulab Yatmihi
Listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. Sugar in My Bowl is the name of this program. By the way, this playlist is up at sugarinmybowl.org. Thank you, Hank Williams, for making that happen. Our associate producer, Hank Williams. What you're listening to right now is for Brother Thompson. It is in tribute to Malachi Thompson. It's Fred Anderson and Hamid Drake from The River. The name of the release is The River to the Ocean, and the piece is called For Brother Thompson. That's Fred Anderson on tenor saxophone, whom I'm speaking over right now, unfortunately. Hamid Drake on drums, frame drum on others. Josh Abrams on bass and Gimbri on others. Jeff Parker on guitar. This is a 2007 Thrill Jockey release. And let's see, is that going on? Yeah, okay. Before that, we heard Musa Balanto. That's Mandingo Griot Society. And that's the name of the release as well, Mandingo Griot Society. As Joseph Thomas on Fender, top bass, shakers, and vocals. Hamid Drake on trap drums, tabla, bells, shakers, vocals. Jali Fode Musa Suso on kora and lead vocals, Desungen and shakers. Adam Rudolph on congas, bongos, timbales, djembe, shakere, bells, shakers, vocals, and this is a 1979 Flying Fish release. And before that, we heard another recording from Mandingo Griot Society. It was called Mama Mane. And before that, we heard Aduna from Abdoulaye Ndaye. And the name of his release, I hope I'm pronouncing it correctly, is Taoue. T-A-O-U-E. And it's Abdoulaye Ndaye on alto, soprano on that one, tenor saxophone on others, and Hamid Drake on drums. And this is a 2003 Just in Time Records release. Before that, we opened the show with our theme, I Want a Little Sugar in My Bowl, Nina Simone, the very best of Nina Simone. Sugar in My Bowl, 1967-1972. It's a RCA BMG release, originally recorded in 1967. And this is a 1998 RCA BMG compilation. Stay tuned for more Hamid Drake. It was so great talking to him. It was so much fun. And we're going to stop talking over Fred Anderson, the late Fred Anderson. Stay tuned for Sugar in My Bowl, continuing with Hamid Drake. My name's Joyce Jones. Stay tuned. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web. I want to come back to Don Cherry, but I want to go back to somebody else you mentioned, and we didn't spend too much time about it, and he seemed to be a very big part of your development, Fred Anderson.
Yes.
Could you tell us about Fred Anderson, those who may not know?
Well, Fred Anderson, I would have to say, as far as music goes, and particularly the music of the tenor saxophone, which is what he played, he's probably one of the greatest innovators of that instrument in our time, but also maybe one of the least known. I met Fred when I was a small child. He came from the same city in Louisiana, town where I was born, Monroe, and his mother and my mother, even though his mother was much older than my mother, they were very good friends. And even Fred's mother, I called her what Fred's children called her, which was Grandma Dee. And our families actually lived together for a couple of years. And so my relationship with Fred goes back to my childhood years, because I've known him as long as I can remember. But I didn't start playing music with him until, like, I was probably 19 years old. And the one thing I have to say that I remember about Fred, I was very young and our families were living together. He would come home from work in the early evening, and the first thing he would do, he'd go down into the basement and practice his instrument, his saxophone, and he'd do that for a couple hours. Then he'd come back up and do whatever else he needed to do, help prepare dinner or whatever it was. But that was a consistent thing that I would see him do, like, every day. And then on the weekends when he wasn't working, he was still practicing, and other musicians would come over and play with him. And this was like the early, early formations of the AACM, which I found out about later. Of course, some of the original members of that organization would come over and they would practice. He was a great baba for me and for many other musicians throughout the city of Chicago and for many people in general. He did tour some, but he felt it was important to have a space, a venue, or like a congregation, you could say, a temple where musicians could come and play and present their music. And he also was raising a family, too. That's one of the reasons he didn't tour quite so much in those early years. But also, he wanted to have a space where music could be presented, and not only just his music, but the music of other musicians, and particularly younger musicians. He wanted to provide an environment that they could, in a live sense, develop their craft, their music, and a place where that would assist them in finding their own unique voices. And so he started out first with a place called the Birdhouse, which was on the north side of Chicago. He was there for a couple of years, but for various reasons, some political reasons, he left that particular space. And then he started working at a venue called the Velvet Lounge, which was owned by his cousin, whose name was Tip. And Fred started working there as a bartender. Then after he was there for a few years, since there was a stage there, you know, Fred, he started inviting different groups to play there. He himself played there occasionally. And then when Tip passed away, Fred took over the Velvet Lounge himself. And then it became like a full-fledged venue to present the music. And so Fred, he was like one of those rare people that comes along from time to time that really inspires people in general, but particularly musicians and artists, to really believe in what they do. And he was one of those beings that did everything he possibly could do to help you find your own unique way. He was one of those sort of selfless people who really put his all in all into his music and into the people that were around him. And he did everything he possibly could do while he was alive to keep a space open and available for young musicians and musicians that were of his age group also to play and present their stuff, their music. And it seemed like what I could see and feel, that he was respected by people from many different places, not just Chicago, but, you know, we toured Europe together several times. And also I noticed every time that he'd come to the Vision Festival in New York, he was widely beloved and respected. And when he passed away, it felt like it caused a deep tremor in New York also, throughout the world, actually, yeah.
Fred Anderson was honored during one of the Vision Festivals.
Yes.
I'm looking. Jazz fans, this is Hank Williams, and welcome to On the Bandstand for June 22nd. In this segment of the show, we bring you aerial listings of Suge and My Bowl guests so you can experience them live. This week's guest is drummer Hamid Drake. There are no immediate shows to announce, but we'll keep you up to date with this segment. We have other listings for you if you want to catch live music this week. Blues woman Alexis P. Suter will be at Roxy and Duke's in Dunellen, New Jersey on June 27th. Go to roxyanddukes.com for info on this show. That's roxyanddukes.com. Saturday, June 28th is shaping up to be a big day music-wise. Last week's guest, drummer J.T. Lewis, will be at the Prospect Park Bandshell for a free show as part of the Celebrate Brooklyn Festival with Sandra St. Victor. Go to brickartsmedia.org for full details. That's BRICArtsMedia.org. The last show, we incorrectly had the date as the 30th. It is indeed the 28th. Several guests will be at NYU's Skirball Center for a Jazz Forum for the Arts benefit performance. Drummers Bobby Sanabria and Michael Carvin, trombonist Steve Turay, and many others will be there. Details and ticket info are at nyuskirball.org. That's nyuskirball.org. And look for the calendar link. Bassist Reggie Workman will have a birthday celebration concert at Sista's Place in Brooklyn. Details are at sistasplace.org. That's Sista's Place, spelled SISTAS.org. Finally, if you're up for a road trip, you can catch pianist Mark Carey's Focus Trio and Dr. Lonnie Smith's In the Beginning Octet at the Saratoga Jazz Festival in Saratoga Springs, New York on June 28th. Details are at the Saratoga Performing Arts Center website at spac.org. That's spac.org. Further ahead in Saratoga Springs, on July 1st, saxophonist Tia Fuller appears at Skidmore College's Jazz Institute with Rufus Reed's Quintet. See skidmore.edu/summerjazz for info. That's skidmore.edu/summerjazz. Also on the horizon, pianist Jerry Allen has a residency at The Stone on the Lower East Side from June 30th to July 6th. On the 6th, you'll be joined by saxophonist Tia Fuller. See thestonenyc.com for info. That's thestonenyc.com. Finally, the Blue Note Jazz Fest wraps up this week with events in several venues. See bluenotejazzfestival.com for a full schedule. That's all for this week. If you missed anything, you can see the listings at the Sugar in My Bowl blog. Go to sugarinmybowl.org and click the link for the blog. We also have coverage from the Vision Fest, including performances by Hamid Drake up there as well. Tonight's playlist and audio from this and previous shows are on the main website. And remember that WBAI is still in serious financial trouble. Help us stay on the air by pledging whatever you can at give2wbai.org, where you can consider becoming a WBAI buddy with a monthly pledge. This is Hank Williams signing off. We're off the WBAI airwaves next week for the last Sunday of the month, but we'll have updated event listings online and be back on air Sunday, July 6th. Either way you connect, we'll see you next time on the Bandstand.
Your mama. Hi, this is Roy Ayers. When I'm in New York, I listen to WBAI 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web.
Don Cherry.
We went into the studio quite a few times and recorded things, but none of that stuff, it didn't get released. You know, So the only documentation with me with Don is Mandingo Griot Society and some things that now you can find on YouTube. One of the groups we had, it was called New Now, and it featured Don Cherry, Carlos Ward, and Bob Stewart.
Wow.
And then there's also another group that played in with Don, it's called Multiculti. Then we had this, the very first times I started playing with Don was actually after Mandingo Griot Society. It was the summer of 78 when he asked, after we did a recording session with Mandingo Griot Society, he'd invited myself and my family at the time. I had two daughters, one, Nada, she was almost turning two, and Shanti was 6 months. He invited us to move to Sweden and to stay with him and his family.
Oh, my.
Which we did.
Okay.
Yeah, we packed up everything and did that. You know, he lived in southern Sweden, in the forest in southern Sweden, with his wife Moki and his son Eagle Eye and his daughter Nina and Cherry. Mm-hmm. Then Adam, he came with us, and they had like a really huge old red schoolhouse that they had turned into a living quarters and kind of like a concert space also. So many musicians would come through there too, many musicians and visual artists and dancers and whatnot. And so there we formed a group also, which consisted of Don, Adam, myself, another percussionist, Trilai Gertu, and a saxophone player that was living in Sweden, who's actually from France. His name is Dudu Boyan. And then we went to Paris and we did a few concerts with Charlie Hayden on bass. Yeah, so there's a lot of recordings out there, but they're not on any particular record label or something like that.
So they're in somebody's bootleg crate.
Yeah, well, yeah, and I still have a lot of them myself. You know?
Oh, wow. Well, yeah. You need to share. Find someone to share.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff that was recorded, these different festivals we did, that was recorded by German radio, French radio, Swedish radio, Finnish radio. So there's a lot of stuff out there.
By the way, how did you wind up traveling so much? Who did you wind up going on the road with when you left the country?
Probably my first experience of playing in Europe was with Fred Anderson.
Okay.
In 78 at the International Festival of Music at Moors, Germany. We had a group. It was Fred, myself, the bass player Brian Smith and George Lewis, and trumpet player Billy Brimfield. And in fact, one of the first groups that I played in with Fred was with George Lewis and Douglas Hewitt and myself, Fred Anderson, a bass player Felix Blackman, and pianist Saji Adebayo. And then after that, things just developed over the years. The end of the summer of 78, we moved to Sweden. And then in 79, I did another trip to Europe with Fred at the Moors Festival. And then we did a couple other concerts in Germany, and we played also in Italy. And then after that, I did a couple, the end of 79, did a couple tours with Don. And then in December of 1980, did a European tour with Don Cherry and Jim Pepper and Don's cousin, Ricky Cherry, who played piano, and a bass player from Sweden named Siggy Krantz. And that tour started in December. And then in January, which would have been the beginning of 81, we did this U.S. French State Department tour of West Africa with Don, Jim Pepper, myself, and Don's cousin, Ricky Cherry. We toured Mali, Cameroon, Ivory Coast, Sierra Leone,
wow,
Nigeria, Benin. So it was a combined places in West Africa where people were colonial language. They were speaking French, and some places where they were speaking English.
Were you speaking French by that point?
Nope.
Okay.
No. And I was very young then, too. And so from then on, things just kept picking up. People hear about you, they call you, and, you know, and you just do a lot of different things. And then after that, I did many tours of Europe with Don. In fact, I played with him up until he passed away. Did his last tour with him also, which was in Germany, Austria, Hungary, France. It was a tour that is also the group knew now, but it was with Carlos Ward, Don Cherry, myself, and Mark Elias on bass.
Wow. Yeah, there's a connection between you and our guest from last week, J.T. Lewis.
Yeah. And actually, JT, we would share gigs with David Murray also.
Uh-huh.
Thank you.
When you went to Africa, the continent, with Don Cherry, is that where you started to really get into the rhythms, or you were set when you went there to explore?
Well, I was already pretty much into them before I went, but being there and hearing things live and seeing with your own eyes, that kind of really consolidates things for you, and it makes it very tactile. You know, you can really touch it and feel it, you know, to see it. And that I learned more.
Right. And there's so much more to learn about
that. Yeah. Exactly. You know, so it just fed me more and just increased in me the desire to learn more about the various rhythmic structures of that particular music. And then I also learned from being there that there is no one music from Africa.
Right.
Even if we're talking about just the Sahel region, let's say, you know, just Mali, Guinea, Gambia, Senegal.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, there's not just one type of music from those regions. There's not just one type of musical rhythms from West Africa in general,
right,
or Central Africa or North Africa or East Africa, you know, or South Africa. They have a very wide and diverse palette there.
Right.
You know, and rhythms would change from village to village.
Right.
You know, because it'd be different people speaking different languages.
Exactly.
It's more than enough for lifetimes of study.
Exactly.
And so it increased my appetite and it broadened my horizon, and whatever I thought I knew was nothing compared to what I found out when I arrived there. You know, if we go up to North Africa, you know, it's so diverse there, and the various rhythms that they play, let's say just on the bandir frame drum, and then the rhythmic structures that are associated with the string instruments and so forth, and the singing, you know, the dance, it's so wide and so varied, and you could spend just a lifetime with just one single form, and that could fill you if you wanted to do that. But if you have a deep thirst and hunger, many like myself have,
mm-hmm.
then you seek out many forms.
Right.
You know, but you realize that all those many forms are just expressions of the one essence. It's reflection you find in many different hues. It's like a single crystal, but like when you put the crystal up to light, to the sun, you see many different colors, you know,
right,
shining through, but it's still that one single crystal.
Right.
All this music, these rhythms and all those things, I see them as kind of like that. You can definitely see a connection with various musical traditions throughout the world, without a doubt. If a person's in tune, you know that it's coming from a single source, this vibration, resonance. But they just manifest in so many different ways depending upon the culture, the language, and the people, land. So you have some cultures that come from the mother essence lineage, you know, divine mother traditions, you know, or looking at divinity from a more feminine perspective.
You have a recording that you dedicate to the feminine.
Yes, uh-huh. Well, there's this project that I put together called Bindu, and there's 3 Bindu recordings out now. There's 2 more I got to do, but the whole concept of Bindu, for me, is dedicated to the divine feminine. And I think it's an ancient concept that people from every culture at some point in time have dealt with, whether it be, it doesn't matter the name. I mean, even Islam and Christianity, Judaism, some of the monotheistic religions, even in those religions, you still find the presence of the divine feminine. Like Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of Jesus, they have a very prominent place. Fatima, the daughter of Prophet Muhammad, and Aisha and Khadija, his wife, they have a very prominent place. If you look at the Arabic language, all the words have a masculine and feminine perspective. Rahman, Rahmana, all these things, mercy and compassion, they're feminine forms. Hinduism, it's just there. All these wisdom goddesses and so forth. So every culture has an expression of this in some way. And so it's just that today, especially in the Semitic world, meaning the worlds of Judaism, Islam, and Christianity, it's mostly seen from the masculine perspective, but it doesn't mean that the feminine isn't there too. Mostly all of the indigenous ways, whether it be the indigenous people of the continents of North, Central, and South America, or in Southeast Asia, they have this way of looking at the divine from the feminine viewpoint, or the viewpoint of Shakti, the primal energy. And so the Bindu groups, I had a teacher, or still have, even though he's passed on. He lived in New York. His name was Lex Hickson.
Oh, yeah.
And he used to do a radio show in New York on WBAI called In Spirit.
Yes.
And he was one of my prime main teachers. And I met him in New York at the, he was an inheritor of several different sacred traditions. One was Islamic Sufism, and there was a mosque that he led in New York. I think the first one was on Mercer Street. It was called Masjid al-Farah. And a couple of years after that, they had a place which is still there. It's on West Broadway. It's in Tribeca. Now, the person that is leading the group that he had in New York, her name is Sheikha Fariha. She's a female Sheikha, or female spiritual leader amongst the particular tradition of Sufism that he followed. Also, he was an adept in Vajrayana Buddhism, or better known as Tibet Buddhism. He was an adept in Zen Buddhism, and he took his Roshi-ship from Roshi Bernard Glassman, who was leading people in New York. Also, he was the inheritor of the way, the Patrick way of Sri Ramakrishna. And also, he was an adept in the Eastern Orthodox Church of Christianity. And so, when I met him, it was very profound for me. But before he passed away, he said that I should take his works, his writings, and use them in my music. And so the Bindu stuff is primarily two of his works that I use. One is from a book called Great Swan. It's meetings with Sri Ramakrishna and Sri Ramakrishna's wife, Srimati Sarada Devi. And the other source is called Hymns to the Mother of the Universe. And it's the mystic poems of a great Bengali saint who... Sri Ramakrishna is from Bengal also. There's a great Bengali saint and poet named Ram Prasad Sen. And he wrote all these poems about the wisdom goddess Kali. And Sheikh Nur, he did translations of that. So those are like the sources, we could say the literary sources of the Bindu Project.
Aspiration of all
One that was under the title of Reggaeology?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, there's three so far. One is just called Bindu, and that was an experimentation with just percussion and reeds, you know, saxophones and clarinets and stuff like that. The first part of the CD opens up with a duet with Nicole Mitchell and myself, her on flute and me on frame drum. And then the rest of the CD is with saxophone player from Chicago, Ernest Dawkins, another saxophonist from Chicago, Greg Ward, Sabir Mateen from New York, and Daniel Carter from New York.
Excellent.
And just me playing various percussion instruments. Part of that is also dedicated to Ed Blackwell, who was one of my mentors and teachers for the drum set.
Yes.
And then the second Bindu is called Blitzful, which features the wonderful voice of a Chicago vocalist by the name of Dee Alexander. And also there's two guitars on that, Jeff Parker playing guitar and Joe Morris playing guitar and banjo. William Parker is on that recording, also playing the acoustic bass and the gimbri. Another Chicago musician, Josh Abrams, is playing acoustic bass and gimbri. And guitarist Jeff Parker, and then myself. That one features a lot of different percussive things and, you know, different instruments. The third one is called Bindu Reggaeology, and it was an experimentation with something that I used to do in the past, but I wanted to build my own also. It's the combination of jazz and reggae together. But in this particular project, I wanted to do this jazz reggae project with people that could improvise also. But also, which I had never heard beatbox and reggae together before, so that's why Napoleon Maddox, a great young beatboxer and rapper from Cincinnati, Ohio, he's on that recording also. And I play in his groups also, and he has a project called Is What, which is like a jazz hip-hop group. And so I have two more Bindu projects to do with this record label, Rogue Art.
Rogue Art, right?
Yeah, Rogue Art. Yeah, it's a record label from Paris. I think the next one will be a very sort of minimalist approach to things. And then the last Bindu that I do with them will be maybe bringing together all of the musicians that performed on the other various Bindu projects and doing like a large group thing.
Wow, that sounds exciting.
Mm-hmm.
William Parker, how did your paths cross?
Yeah, many people say that William and I are the brothers from another mother. Well, William and I had heard of William, you know, before we met. But actually, we met in Germany. We were part of the formation of a group called Die Like a Dog that was formed by the German saxophonist, Peter Brutzmann. And Peter was the one that actually brought William and I together. I think it was in 88, maybe. And William and I, from the moment we, like, played the first boom and ka-chang together, we knew that something was going to keep going and keep happening from this, you know, meeting and relationship. For me, it was just a spontaneous and knowing on the spot, you know, that, wow, being someone that plays bass like how I like to coach drums, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then we just connected immediately, and we continued connecting. And so we were doing these projects with Peter, and then William asked me if I would like to record with him with the group O'Neill's Porch, which was with Lewis Barnes, Lewis Flip Barnes, Rob Brown, William, and myself. And so that was the first recording that we did together outside of the Die Like a Dog stuff. And then I found out something about William, which I knew to some degree, but I didn't know fully how such a great composer he is.
Yes.
And so when he put together this O'Neill's Porch group with Rob, Flip, William, and myself, it was one of those things where it's like, okay, this group I could play with anytime. We could do anything, go anywhere. And I knew it was going to be one of those groups that would just, no matter how long we played together, it would just continue to grow and grow and grow and grow. William and I have a way of playing together I think that's very unique, and Flip and Rob have a way of playing together that's very unique. And those two things were just put together. You know, then after that, we had the group Raining on the Moon, which was basically the quartet, but also featuring Lena Conquest on vocals. From Raining on the Moon came Raining on the Piano, which was the quintet with Lena, and then with the pianist Hiro Yamamoto, which then the group became the sextet. And then so many other projects from there, you know, the Curtis Mayfield project and so many different things. And then William and I playing with a lot of different people together, you know, and then the groups with, like, Cooper Moore, then the groups with Fred Anderson and Kid Jordan, and so many different things. Even to this day, it just continues to grow and expand, and it's nonstop. It's a situation that I'm just very thankful that I was in the right place at the right time to be a part of, and to meet William and to continue to play music with him, but also to continue to keep up our friendship. So it's an ongoing relationship with WP, with Brother William.
Peter Brossman.
Well, I met Peter Brossman in 1987. We did a duet concert in Chicago together. He was coming to Chicago, and the German musicians that he was traveling with, they were having some visa problems. And so he had to do a concert in Chicago, and he had spoken with a friend of his named Pope Carr, who lives in New York. He just didn't want to come to Chicago and do a solo concert. So he asked her if there was a drummer that he could use in Chicago, and she said, yes, I know someone. I have a friend that lives in Chicago who's worked with Don Cherry, and he just cut off the road with a Danish group that she was helping to manage. It was called the Pierre Dodge and the New Jungle Orchestra. So Hope contacted the guy who was presenting the concert, Leo Krumpholz, in Chicago, and she asked Leo if he would contact me to see if I wanted to do this concert with Peter Brossman. And so he did. I said, okay, I can do it because I had known of Peter. I said, but I can only do it if you provide me with a drum set, because after I do the concert with Peter, I had to do a concert down the street with one of the local Chicago reggae bands I was working with, because we were going to open up for Mika Baruka that night.
Wow.
This group called Kwame and One Africa. So Peter and I, we did a little sound check that late afternoon, and it felt good playing together. And then I went back to the other club, which was down the street, and did my sound check for Kwame One Africa to open for Muta. And Muta's drummer, his name was Desi, he asked me if he could use my drum set, you know, that night when they played. I said, no problem. I said, hey, listen, man, I'm playing down the street with a saxophone player from Germany. Maybe you'd like to come to the concert. So he said, okay. And what happened was Muta Baruka's whole group, including Muta Baruka himself, came to the concert. And they all sat in the front row. And from the moment we started, their mouths were like open, dropped open, and they were that way for the whole concert.
Wow.
And then later they came up to me, and because it's interesting, because I hadn't opened up for Muta Baruka before, but this time, after this concert, he came up to me, and he said, Drummy, he said, man, you wicked man. No. He said, I never heard Drummy like that before.
Wow.
They had never heard, like, a duet with, like, drums and saxophone, first of all. and especially the type of music we were doing. We were playing free and open, but also I was putting a lot of grooves and stuff in there. They had never heard a saxophone player like Peter. Desi, the drummer, he wanted me to make a copy of the concert, you know, from the recording so he could play for his drummer friends in Jamaica. Muda Baruka wanted a copy so he could play on his radio station in the Grill.
Wow.
Then after that, I opened up for Muta with different reggae bands after that, too, and we became pretty good friends, you know. Then it's interesting because then after that, he really started listening to my reggae drumming more. It was very interesting. And so from there, Peter and I, our relationship formed, and we started doing duets together. He started coming to Chicago more, and we did our first CD together called Dried Rat Dog. And then the group Die Like a Dog formed, and then Chicago Tentet, and, you know, the rest is history. But Peter, after we played together, he came to me to the reggae concert where I was opening for Muda Baruka also.
Wow.
So that showed me that, wow, okay, this man, he's open to some other things, too. I want to say something about Peter. Peter was also very close with Don Cherry. Don Cherry was very influential for Peter because Peter, he went through a period where he wasn't receiving much respect, you know, in Europe. You know, this was like in the probably late 60s, early 70s and stuff. Then Don Cherry, he called Peter once to come to Paris and do some concerts with him. And after that, Peter told me that musicians in Europe started respecting him more after Don had kind of showed others that Peter could play and Peter was his friend and,
wow,
you know, and you shouldn't treat him this way.
Wow.
So Don's had his effect, his energy, his, we can say, his blessings have had a great effect upon many, 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 many. And that's why even to this day, many people call him the father of world music. He was one of the first, him and Yusuf Lateef.
Right.
Were two of the first to really do like this blending of jazz and African-American music and music from other cultures.
And you played with both of them.
Yes, I played with Yusuf Lateef also.
With Adam on some occasions, yeah.
Mm-hmm, yes.
Now, Bill Laswell and Material. Tell me about
I've done a lot of recording for Bill.
Yes.
I still play with him.
Tell me about the event that you did with Material, Gigi with Material. Hurts talking over this. This is Gufella. That's the name of the song, Gufella. Gigi with Material, it's called. We'll find out from Hamid Drake that they actually have another name when they're on the road. Mescana, Ethiopia. This is live in Kearns, Austria. MOD Technologies 2010 release. And before that, we heard Peter Brossman, William Parker, and Hamid Drake. Never Run But Go, Part 4. It's from, Hank has it on the playlist at sugarmybowl.org. I don't have the release title. What the heck is it? Wait a minute. Never Too Late, But Always Too Early. That's it. And that's Ermite 2003 release. Before that, we heard, Take Us Home, Hamid Drake and Bindu from Bindu Regalogy, Rogue Art 2010 release. Before that, we heard Banish from David Murray's Black Saint Quartet live in Berlin. That's a Jazzworks.com 2010 release. Before that, we heard Lama Kino, Fred Anderson, and Hamid Drake from Back Together Again, 2004 Thrill Jockey Records release. Before that, Brother Thompson, we talked about that. That was from the River to the Ocean. Let's hear the rest of Gigi, the material on Sugar in My Bowl, a conversation with Hamid Drake on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, WBAI.org on the web.
Yeah, that was Bill's wife from Ethiopia. Actually, the way that I met Bill was in 1985. He was producing a CD project for Mandingo Griot Society, which featured Herbie Hancock. It was called Watasito. And from that recording, I did some recording with Herbie Hancock also through Bill.
Yes, so, Future Shock and Sound System.
That's right.
You played cymbals.
Well, no, I played hi-hats and did tom fills and stuff like that.
Okay.
Because all the music was electronic. Cymbals, but it was hi-hats, because there were some hi-hat parts that he said he had tried some other drummers in New York, but they couldn't play the hi-hat parts with the metronome, with the click track. And he tried some very well-known popular drummers, and they couldn't do it. And then he asked me if I'd like to give it a shot if I could do it. I said, no problem. Then he asked Suso, he said, well, how may I be able to do it? And Suso said, oh, man, don't even worry about it. So it was just playing the hi-hat parts with the click track.
Uh-huh.
You know, and so since a lot of the music was electronic, and we did one take, I like knocked it out on the first take, and we did three extra takes also, just for safekeeping, knocked them all out, played fills and stuff like that. So I was like, oh, this is easy.
I was always curious about that. I saw cymbals, like, what on earth does that mean? So thank you for clarification.
And see, what it was, a lot of it came from just spending a lot of time playing African music and R&B and reggae, where, your tempo thing, you have to be pretty steady. And so then with Bill, I started playing with Bill in a lot of different situations and doing recordings with him. Sometimes we'd go in the studio and just do drum and bass tracks, and then he would take those tracks and use them for a lot of different CDs.
I see. Okay.
Okay, a lot of different recordings. But what happened, he had met Gigi, and we were on the road together in Italy with a group called Soma. And so then he told myself and the percussionist from Senegal, Aid Ding, about Gigi, and we said he had met to Chris Blackwell, the guy from Island Records.
Right.
He had met this singer, Gigi, from Ethiopia. And so then Gigi and Bill hooked up. So I received a call from Bill. He said he wanted me to come to New York and Ayeep to come to New York and lay all the foundation tracks for Gigi's, her first CD. And so what we did was we had met Gigi. And I think first we went out to dinner the night before the recording, and then the next day we met at Bill's studio. We all sat down on the floor. Ayeep sat down on the floor with the chatans, the percussion clay pots. I sat down on the floor with the tablas. Bill was on the floor with his bass, and Gigi was sitting on the floor. So she just started singing. She just started singing these songs, and so then we started playing some rhythms around the song. And so from that, we worked out the bass lines. And then basically what we did was I just took the rhythms that I was playing on the tablas and put them on the drum set for all the tracks. And then we laid all the foundation tracks, you know, for her first CD, and with guitar and keyboards. And then the horn players and stuff, they came in and overdubbed their parts. And then Gigi laid the vocal parts. But that first CD was based upon us listening to her sing, and we developed the whole rhythmic structure from that, because we didn't do the music. We weren't playing the traditional Ethiopian rhythms. And then, you know, we did her other CDs in a very similar way.
Miss Ghana, Ethiopia. Where did that take place?
It's with myself, Bill Lazo, Ayeep, with Peter Applebaum and Stephen Bernstein, and a guitar player from Austria. I did all of Gigi's CDs with her.
She has an amazing voice. Amazing.
Oh, yeah. And we played in Ethiopia together, too.
Oh, great.
When we played in Ethiopia, it was at Haile Selassie Park. There was maybe 25,000 people came out to the concert.
Ooh.
And they were all singing her songs. It was amazing. You know, I'd never been in an experience like that where people like they either light candles or they hold up the cigarette lighters and they're moving the flames back and forth. But her group, when we would tour, though, it was always Abyssinia Infinite.
Oh, okay. Speaking of things that you hadn't done before, working with Amiri Baraka during I Plan to Stay a Believer, Inside Songs of Curtis Mayfield, how did that impact you?
Yeah, I was talking about that in a couple of those panel discussions at the Vision Festival.
Yes.
Well, I would say probably all of the people that were in that Inside Songs of Curtis Mayfield group, I think I was the one that probably had the less physical contact and experience with Amiri prior to the forming of the group. Because, you know, everybody's from the East Coast, you know, and they will see New York, they will see Amiri here, see Amiri there, see Amiri here, see Amiri there.
Right.
I would see him occasionally at the Vision Festival. And I think I've worked with Amiri once with David Murray prior to the forming of the Inside Songs of Curtis Mayfield.
Oh, okay.
But it was through that group that I got to spend a lot of time with him, because we did quite a few tours and stuff together. And Amiri, you know, I got to be really close up with him, to him, and see him, and see how he would express himself when he was reciting his poetry, his bodily mannerisms, and to see how he was also when we were off stage. You know, he was forever a teacher, but also he was forever a human being, you know.
Yeah.
You know, and showing great humanity. And, you know, we would all have discussions about just about everything under the planet. But also I think he had an effect upon my drumming, too, because I would listen to him and watch him, how his word forms would come out, and with the rhythm of him.
Right.
You know, and so that really, it gave me another attunement, I would say, a way of approaching rhythm and melody on the drums, you know, and just I would see how he would work with emptiness and form. And because he'd be into some spaces where it'd be like really full, be a lot of spoken stuff. And then there would be like a breath, a break, where there'd be like these empty spaces. And it's like it would leave you in this place of anticipation for the next words, you know? So, I mean, he knew from a drummer's perspective, let me say, he knew how to, in drummer's language, he knew how to shape a solo, we could say.
Right.
You know.
Right.
He knew the importance of being spontaneous, but also he knew the importance of executing, how to execute things in a certain way. When to do accents, you know, when to do big crescendos, you know, so forth and so on. And so I kind of peeped that, you know, from the drumming perspective. But he impacted my life also prior to meeting him, but also being with him, that he was one of the greatest literary geniuses in the history of the world, and also in the history of African-American culture and the history of just American culture in general. So just being in the presence of a being like that, who also you could talk to.
Yes, yes.
You know, who wasn't standoffish with you.
Right, right.
And who looked upon you as, you know, someone that was also creative and has something to say. That alone had this great impact. You know, I mean, it's like, I'm still digesting it. For me, it was like spending time with Don Cherry, which I spent a lot of time with, but being with, like, Yusuf Lateef. Also, for me, it was like being with another one of my great mentors. He came originally from Nubia. His name was Hamza El Din, and he played oud and frame drum. He's one of my first frame drum teachers. He spent time with us in Chicago. Twice he visited us and did concerts here and stayed with us. And he was a person that I'd met years after I had known about and who I'd listened to for years. And so to have become a friend of his and to be accepted by him, it had extraordinary impact. And because these people, they're deep, 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 serious people. I mean, their wells run really deep, mm-hmm. but they're just natural, too, and with great senses of humor.
Yes.
Their sense of humor never abandoned, and they never left that. You know, even if they'd be talking about the destruction of the world, you know, but still, they were never without their sense of humor.
Yes.
And there's always a light in those eyes. You know?
Yes. Two more folks I want to ask you about, and then I'm going to get off this phone.
Bring it home. Right?
Yes. Ferrell Sanders. How'd you wind up working with him?
I met Ferrell through Bill Laswell, actually.
Okay. Yeah, I noticed he produced a couple of these recordings.
Yeah, he produced, the first recording I did with Ferrell was called Message from Home.
Yes.
After that recording, Ferrell, he asked me if I'd like to go on the road with him. I said, sure, you know, and it was a group with myself, Ferrell, Steve Neal, and William Henderson on piano, mm-hmm. Steve Neal on bass. We toured a couple of years together, and then after Steve, we had the bass player, Alex Blake.
Yes. You
know? And I toured with Ferrell for about 5 years. And I did the CD Message from Home with him.
Mm-hmm.
And also we did a CD that we put out ourselves. It was from a live concert at the Montreal Jazz Festival. It's Ferrell Sanders, myself, and Adam Rudolph.
Yes.
Spirits.
Yes.
Know? And then I'm on a lot of Bill Laswell stuff with Ferrell.
Oh, okay.
You know? And, but Spirits, I love Spirits because it was just percussion and saxophone, and Ferrell plays a lot on it. So he's one of those other people that kind of came up listening to and then got the opportunity to play quite a bit with him and be around him a lot and be a friend, you know, and tour and everything. During a certain period of my life, there was two people that were very influential on me. That was Ferrell Sanders and Tariya Sangeetananda. That's Alice Coltrane.
Okay.
I met Alice Coltrane when I was 16, actually. She did a concert here in Chicago with herself, Ben Riley, and Charlie Hayden. And I got to meet her, and there's this prayer book that I had at the time, and she signed it for me. I don't have the prayer book anymore, but I still have the page that she signed. And at that time, I was still going by the name that I grew up with, which is Hank. And I remember what she wrote. She said, "Dear Hank, may the universal cosmic spirit of the universe flow through you always.
Mm.
Love, Tariya, Alice." And then we wrote each other a few letters, you know, and I sent her some books. One of my deepest wishes was to visit her at her ashram in Southern California, but never got the opportunity to do that. But I actually have a lot of dreams about it.
Wow.
And she's still someone that I hold this day very high. Yes, so Ferrell, to this day, he's one of my greatest mentors and influences.
Now, there's somebody that he's younger than you, but you seem to be moving in a similar fashion. Will Calhoun.
Oh, Will. Will and I, we're friends, and he's a great drummer, you know, great percussionist.
You ever consider doing something together?
Every time we see each other every now and then, and it's like, it feels like that thought kind of runs through both of our streams, and now that you mention it, I might have to contact him, you know,
we
might have to talk about that, yeah.
Because I keep planting it into him. I plant into him that he should work with you, and so this is my turn to plant into you that you should work with him.
Okay, and would you ask him that, what did he say?
He said, oh man, yeah, I really like it. I mean, we do have to do something together.
Yeah, so. I feel the same, you know. We both work with Ferrell. We both work with Bill, doing a lot of different things. We follow some similar pathways. You know?
Exactly.
We both like the rock world, you know.
Exactly.
A lot of stuff, you know. You know, I've worked with Vernon.
Yeah.
Because they had the group together.
Right.
But that would be beautiful. In fact, I'm going to have to really figure out a way to do that. Thanks for bringing that up. Thank
Yay.
You. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Hamid Drake, for spending this time with us.
It's been my pleasure sharing with you. Thank you so much. I'm very grateful.
was the conversation that I had with Hameed Drake. Thank you so much, Hameed Drake. For real. I'm so glad this happened. And I hope you enjoyed hearing from him as well. And what we're listening to right now is from that release with Pharoah Sanders, Adam Rudolph, and Hameed Drake. It's called... Come on. This is called Ancient Peoples, and the name of the release is Spirits. It's Pharoah Sanders on wood flute and tenor saxophone and others, and is Adam Rudolph on bamboo flute and bindir frame drum, as is Hameed Drake, and he's on tablas and vocals and others, and Adam Rudolph is playing djembe and gong and others, and stay tuned for La Nueva Alternativa coming up next on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. We'll be back on the 6th with Bobby Sanabria. Yes, he was involved in the journey, so we're going to have him as a sugar guest again. So stay tuned. This is WBAI New York, as I mentioned, 99.5 FM. WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, WBAI.org on the web. La Nueva Alternativa coming up soon.
This is Sonia Sanchez. I urge you to give your generous support to listener-sponsored community radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York.